All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. I'm in a remote location. I'm on a remote. Not really. I'm in Chicago, as I was on Monday. I'm still here, though I was speculating on Monday, for those of you who follow week to week and listen to me yammer on here at the beginning, I speculated on Monday because I recorded it Sunday before I'd done my show at the Thalia Hall here in Chicago. And I speculated pretty good. It went not pretty good, actually. It went great. I'd never been to the venue. It was an amazing venue. It's in sort of a Latino part of town, so I was able to kind of show up in the neighborhood about an hour before and get some pollo, like grilled pollo, some grilled chicken. It was really good. I mean, I just sat there alone with a half a grilled chicken, some guac, some salsas, and my little bag and my notes, and processed. Then I walked around the corner and did the show. My opening act, local comedian, Chelsea Hood, great job, did a great job. And then Jimmy O. Yang. I don't know if I told you on Sunday, but I ran into him here at the hotel, and I just had him on the podcast, and he was in town. He literally stepped into the elevator, but I thought, why not have him on the show, do a few minutes? It was a good time. It was actually fun. It was fun to sort of have that moment where you're like, hey, another comic. There's a guy I know, and he's got the goods. And so I gave him a guest spot. So Chelsea Hood did a beautiful opening set. And then they brought on the surprise guest from Silicon Valley in the Crazy Rich Asians movie, number one movie in the country. Jimmy O. Yang laid it down for 7 minutes, got some good laughs, and I went up, and I ended up doing like an hour and 45. You know who else was there? Andre Royo, who's also been on my show. I'm not just dropping names. These are people that I know because I met them because they come on my show. Andre Royo, you know, Bubs from The Wire. He's also on Empire. He's in town shooting Empire, which he does every year. And I ran into him just out of nowhere in the lobby, and he wanted to come to the show, so he came. The guy who's directing the show I'm on now, Easy, Joe Swanberg, the filmmaker, he came down. That was my celebrity VIP section alongside of my my parents' friends, Shelly and Shelly, and their son, Brad, who handles my money, and his wife. Some lifetime family friends. There was that sort of old-school Jewish component and then the celebrity component. It was all very exciting. Then about 600 or 700, however many Chicagoans that came down to the show. And it was great. The audiences in Chicago are fucking amazing. I honestly felt that it was one of the best shows I've had lately because it was so loose and so engaged with the audience and just moving through stuff conversationally. Also, Jimmy O. Yang and his friend, they stayed for the whole show. They enjoyed the show. We went out to this place right across from the hotel here, and we just fucking destroyed a double porterhouse steak. That guy, it's hilarious, right? He's this little dude, but now that he's not poor anymore, as he says, like, he just can't help but like order as much as possible. And it was 11 at night, and we're doing a double porterhouse. We got oysters, we got sauteed mushrooms, broccolini, asparagus, frog legs. Yeah, frog legs. It was just an insane, buttery feast, just a carnivorous, buttery blowout, and it was great. And I'd like to add, I did not really eat any carbs. Is that important? Did I mention that Tanya Donnelly is on the show from the band Belly and also from the Breeders? Jason Bateman came by, and he's got season 2 of Ozark that comes out this Friday, August 31st. You'll be able to stream all episodes, and right now you can catch up on season 1 if you missed it. It's an interesting show, kind of menacing. It makes you feel like Southern dirty, Southern dark, Southern scary. It's got a tone, and he directed a lot of them, which I didn't realize completely until I talked to him. I like Jason, and it was nice for him to stop by. So this is me and Jason Bateman.
You do get some fantastic people. When I saw Tom York and Paul Thomas Anderson,
that turned out to be a great Tom York interview because it was just him and I.
He doesn't do these.
Exactly.
And Paul Thomas Anderson doesn't sit down and talk.
Yeah, but you know him, right?
A tiny bit.
I mean, like, I thought he was some dark wizard. He's just some goofball from the valley. He's a genius. Yeah. But as a person, he's
us. Yeah, he lives in Tarzana.
Yeah.
I love what he says about kids. He said, I mean, I'll paraphrase this, yeah. But the spirit of it was, he was talking about kids, and he asked him about, you know, so you got four kids or five kids? And he's like, yeah.
A lot of kids.
Yeah, he's like, it's like having multiple warm fires burning around the house. You know, like, maybe I'm sort of projecting here, but the spirit of it, I got, like, you know, you don't have to hang out with them. It's just nice to hear them running around. You know, you have multiple fires in that. Right. So multiple rooms are very warm and welcoming.
But the fire could get out of control at any second.
Well, you got a screen in front of it.
Oh, yeah.
I.e. mom or friend or nanny or something that, you know, where you can stay in your bubble of narcissism if you're like me.
Sure. Yeah. Just insulated. Yeah. How many do you have, though? Two?
I've got two. Yeah. Two little girls.
That's
11
enough,
and six.
Right? Oh, that's so.
I would take 12. But again, that's the narcissism in me. I do love a wood fire.
Because my brother has three kids and. And he approaches it with sort of a spite against how he felt our parents did. So, like, isn't there an element of it that it's sort of like, I'm going to do this correctly. I'm going to be...
Yes, but I think your instinct and who you really are takes over despite all your best intentions. And so my instinct, my natural sort of rest pace is to... Not in an Ayn Rand sort of way, but I'm sort of this advocate for kind of taking care of number one, just in the practicality of it all. Like, in other words, if I'm in a bad mood, I'm garbage for everyone.
Yeah.
Right. So if I indulge, you know, the narcissism, and I understand that that's a pejorative, and I don't really mean it as that, and I'm not proud of it or bragging about it, but
you're just self-centered. You're not pathologically narcissistic.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the sense that I just know enough about myself that if I am feeling bad about myself, if I haven't taken care of the things I know I should take care of,
right,
whatever that list might be, whether it be, you know, exercising or doing my homework or studying or whatever it is, that stuff will eat at me.
Right.
It will make me short.
Yeah.
And then I'm not a good husband, I'm not a good dad, I'm not a good friend, et cetera, et cetera. So I have a sort of a high standard personally for myself. And so that list of things for me to accomplish is a close cousin of narcissism. Because I got to get all the stuff done before I can really focus on, you know, the other things that are equally important, but they just happen to sit behind my burden of maintenance.
Maintenance. But there, you do hit a level where you're like, okay, daddy's coming out of the room now.
Yes, yeah, for sure. My mind and my eye is on that for sure.
Right. But you're not sort of like, there's no end.
No, I'm not overly indulgent
shit out of yourself constantly.
OCD or anything like that. No. Yeah. I'm just...
Well, that's why I think the character in Ozark is like that. When you got that role, you must have thought, this is perfect.
Like, exactly. Yeah, he's perfect in that he felt like, you know, he's taking care of number one, but he's got this other element of kind of arrogance or hubris where he thinks that he can kind of take a shortcut and be even a better provider by playing fast and loose with his version of ethics and morals and then all of that stuff slaps him in the face.
I watched, like, I hadn't watched it, but when you wanted to come on, I'm like, all right, well, I guess I'm going to watch it.
You didn't, you can't finish it, though.
I did.
You finished it?
I finished it.
Oh, my God. Thank you so much. It's like, there's five movies.
I watched all of them.
I'm surprised anybody finishes these things because it's a lot. It's 10 hours.
And there's so many of them out there.
That's what I mean. There's much to pick from.
Well, you know, it's like the dark, creepy world of the South and sort of like, you know, demonic, a new take on the demonic hillbilly. and just sort of this idea that you and Laura Linney can, you know, maintain some sort of relationship in amidst these type of problems, which are ridiculous.
Yeah, ridiculous, mostly because these two fancy city folks think they can come down and kind of big city these hillbillies, and they're in for a rude awakening.
But they're big citying the hillbillies because they're in trouble.
Like this, right. The desperation factor. It's just, it's sort of amazing that in every episode, there's a point where you're like, okay, I can get us out of this.
Right.
Like I've got this. And then it's just sort of like, what the fuck? You know, now there's heroin involved.
Right. Well, he can't get all the way on top of it because then the show would be over. So it ends up being the significant barriers end up coming as a result of either, again, his hubris or the hillbillies being more worthy of further thinking.
Right, and also the fact that, you know, you can't control people. I mean, yeah. Which I imagine as that character and maybe as yourself is frustrating.
Yeah, playing people that have it all together.
Yeah.
Is a little boring, you know, and it's not compelling because that supposedly is us.
Well, this
right?
guy hasn't,
in the audience.
Right. He hasn't come unhinged yet. Does that happen in season two? I mean, like he's come close.
There are parts. Yeah. I mean, the ball of yarn or rubber bands or whatever, you know, continues to fray. But as one area becomes restitched, another one starts to pop and you just can't keep, nothing ever gets fully intact enough
right.
to where we can end the show and they can go back to Chicago and get on with a pleasantly boring life.
Right. But so like the way we left it was you've pitched this incredible casino boat idea to the Mexican drug cartel guy and to the heroin hillbilly.
Yeah.
And your family is gone undercover. That's where we're at.
Right.
And you have a friend in the hillbilly girl, the criminal genius.
Well, yeah, questionable. But she's a partner, a local partner.
Great actress.
Yeah, she's fantastic. Julia Garner. She's really
Where'd she
really
come from?
I mean, she lives in New York.
Yeah. Is she Southern?
She is not. No.
Wow. She really did it.
Yeah. Well, casting director Alexa Fogel put a lot of really talented people in front of us, and thank God they
You guys were. Are great. Your kids are great. That
yeah.
Your son is amazing.
Yeah, right?
What the fuck?
I know it. Yeah. So,
who's the old man? Because I've seen him forever.
Harris Yulin.
He's great.
Yeah.
Always a little menacing, that guy.
Yeah.
Even if he's playing a nice guy.
And you've seen him in everything.
He's in Scarface. He's the corrupt yeah. cop in Scarface. He
and
always
like,
plays sort of a creepy, powerful heavy of some
yeah.
kind.
Like a handful of Starsky and Hutches, too.
Oh, way know? Back.
Like, yeah. Just everything.
Yeah, forever. Yeah. I think he's real good in this.
He's fantastic. He's yeah. such a good dude.
I was wondering how you were going to get out of like that repetition of like, you know, it just keeps escalating. And at what point does your suspending your disbelief become an issue?
Right. Well, that is the burden of a very, very smart group of writers
yeah.
that we have. I mean, you do have to keep the escalation going, which is tantamount to going to a concert and you want to see the band play the hits.
Right.
I mean, you know, you're fine with, you know, kind of you can mix up the solo a little
yeah.
bit, but let's hear the song. Like, I don't want you unplugging everything and doing the acoustic version
right,
of your
right,
big
yeah,
hit.
Yeah.
So,
don't speed it up.
Right. So do what we loved about the first year. Have a compelling escalation
yeah.
to the plot.
Yeah.
Further complicate the relationships. But now, you know, we finished season two. Season two starts the end of August. And so season three, if we're lucky enough to get one, the burden is on us to not create a third season, but a third movie. You know, like
sure.
the second year
yeah.
was a sequel.
Yeah.
And the third year needs to be a whole nother movie with a different beginning, middle, and end. And it can't just be a third version of what you've done for year one and year two. Something's got to be introduced that the changes the calculus for everything.
Well,
without jumping the shark, like that's always the
right
balance,
right
know?
Yeah, and don't become redundant and don't do something that's totally ridiculous.
You got to hit the middle. Yeah,
it's weird that like, you know, you killed off some pretty significant cast members.
Yep.
In the first season.
Yeah, I think there were 15 deaths, and I think we got something pretty close to that in the second year. You know, it doesn't drive the narrative, but we do recognize that that's a bit of an obligation, I think, in today's you know,
what, killing
of,
people?
Well, in these types of shows, I yeah. think that, you know, these streaming
sure.
Serialized shows.
Yeah.
There's an excitement I think that the audience has where if you kill a significant character, the stakes rise from an audience standpoint. Like, oh, okay, I'd like to see how these people who are writing this story are going to get us to the finish line without that guy.
Well, I think that's true. I think that, like, if you're a sophisticated watcher, that you do realize, like, with this show in particular is a good example, that it's definitely a writer show. I mean, you guys have to act it,
sure,
and it's good writing, but you do start to, at a certain point, where you just become impressed with these narrative twists or how this your character is going to get out of this or what's right. going to, and it becomes almost like an exercise of a, you know, mental and emotional escape and finding a balance.
Yeah. It's not too dissimilar from a book in that, you know, yeah. It's not a visual medium. A book is all reliant on the complexities of the stories, the way in which you dangle a cliffhanger at the end of each episode/chapter.
Right.
What is the overall theme? What's the overall plot? And then hopefully our visual and musical component is rises to the same level of the plot stuff, you know. So there's that sort of recipe.
And you guys are acting the fuck out of it, so that's good. So
well,
like even if even if something's a little sort of like no, like but they're selling it.
Well, yeah, and that's sort of my job is, you know, the guy that's looking at all the cuts and making sure that everything stays consistent throughout 10 episodes, even though I don't direct all of them.
How many did you direct?
The first year I did 4 of the 10, and this year I only did 2 of the 10. So I could
It's hard, too, to direct yourself.
Well, I mean, it's...
Running back and forth from the...
It's
playback.
It's actually you know, the acting is so sort of comfortable for me at this point that it allows me to just be aware of all the other parts of the process while we're rolling.
Yeah.
So it's actually more efficient because I don't have to direct that guy.
Right.
You know, that guy's reading my mind for what he needs to do on the next take. So,
and you got a good DP who's the tone is established.
Because
that's one thing about this show is, like, you know, you feel dirty after. Like, you know, it lingers with you. If the episode doesn't linger, the fucking South does.
Yeah.
That part of it, or well, whatever that is.
That was the draw for me originally with the show, reading the first two scripts. That, well, this is something that I want to direct because I see that what the story is demands a certain visual kind of world, atmosphere, palette, tone, whatever it is, so that these story elements are appropriate. In other words, people aren't growing poppies and killing people or doing whatever in a place that has fully saturated color and is in a lot of hard light and it can't look like a Disney show.
Yeah.
So all of that stuff was really the most fun I've had on the show is the directing element of it and establishing the look and crewing up and grabbing a bunch of people that are reading the same scripts.
Did
that
you
I'm
do
reading.
The first four? Like, I mean,
I did the first two,
so
and then
did
I did
establish.
The last two.
Yeah. You were the guy.
Yeah. That was really important. I mean, the original plan was for me to do all of them, and that's why I said yes to it. And then when we got right up to scheduling and budgeting, I realized I couldn't create enough prep time to do all of them.
Oh, to do.
And that was a big disappointment. But as the executive producer, that is sort of that oversight position that a director gets in film is the equivalent in television, sort of that executive producer role.
So that was your deal. You're executive producer and you're the director of the stage setting.
As many as I can do.
But the first two are the most important in sort of setting the tone.
So you're casting.
And you're the star.
Yeah.
So this was all, and they approached you, or is that, when you read this stuff, that was what you wanted?
Well, they came to me about, they actually didn't even come to me. These were the first two scripts were the only ones that were written.
Yeah.
And my agent read them, and they were in the office of abandoned scripts, a floor or two below his office.
Yeah.
He had a canceled lunch and he read these two scripts. And he said, I just read the best two scripts I've ever read. And I said, well, what fancy client are they for of yours? Because I'm low man on, on his roster.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And he said, no, I think they'd be good for you. And I said, well, what is it? He says, well, it's the first two episodes of a series. I go, a limited series, you know, one that has a finite ending. He said, no, it would be an ongoing show. And I said, well, we're looking for a film for me to direct.
Yeah.
That would be an escalation from the first two films I directed, something with more scope and more schedule and more responsibility and complications. And he said, well, I think this could qualify as those things if they let you direct all of them. And I said, well, yeah, you're right. That would be a 600-page movie.
Yeah.
And he said, let's ask him about it. I said, okay. Do you think that they would even be open for that? Have they even, they haven't called us, right? He goes, no, I just found these scripts. I go, okay, so first you have to call them and say, hey, do you know who my client Jason Bateman is? And B, he's interested in your show. C, do you give a shit? And D, he wants to direct them all.
Yeah,
so
he wants to do all of them. Yeah.
Right. So basically the response was, thank you. Yes, we know who he is. Thank you very much for your interest. We're out to, you know, the fancy directors that shall remain nameless, like really fancy directors.
Right.
And so I said to my agent, I said, that's enough. let's not embarrass ourselves by saying we want to be included in the conversation. He said, no. Just take a meeting with them. It's like, okay, great. So I'm nervous as hell taking a meeting with people. I know clearly I'm well beneath their target.
But when you do that, though, do you act like the character and just sort of take charge and go into a whole pitch?
God, no. No. Because then they'd, you know, say, get this douchebag out of our office. So I just as humbly and as sincerely as possible tried to explain how I saw the show, literally what it would look like, what it would sound like, what other shows they can imagine I am going to try to sort of comps, you know. And that went well enough for them to say, okay. And then we pitched Netflix, and Netflix said the same thing, and away we went. But as I said, unfortunately, I couldn't, it would have been...
It's a lot, man.
The pre-production would have been about a year, and then post-production, the editing and all that stuff, would have been that and then some.
I think it sounds like you did a good amount, and you were able to also, like, no matter how comfortable you are with the acting, I mean, you still got to do it.
Correct, but it makes my job as a director more. It's helpful for me to have a hand on the wheel in front of the camera and another hand behind the camera if I'm trying to hit a really small target tonally, you know?
Yeah, and you got nominated for acting and for directing, right? For Emmys.
Yeah.
That's great.
It was a fun morning, to put it lightly.
Have you been nominated before?
I have,
Arrested,
yeah.
Did you win?
No. And I won't be winning this year, but it'll be a fun date night for me and my wife.
I think I'll be there. Glow was nominated. But I think the cast gets to go, don't we?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Do we get to sit in the good seats or no?
No, you'll be upstairs.
Oh, upstairs?
I'm
yeah.
kidding.
I've never been. There's so many of us.
I bet you do a tux real well. I think that...
I have a black Tom Ford suit.
That'll work.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you own a tux, right?
Yes.
Yeah. See, I didn't buy a tux. I bought a black suit. This is all new to me.
Well, it's the same thing.
I mean,
a black tie. You can either wear a long tie or a bow tie.
And then you're set.
Yeah.
Fuck it.
Yeah. Your talent. You can wear tennis shoes.
Yeah, to be that guy.
Especially since you won't be standing up. Yeah, no one will be the wiser.
Right. Be the pretend I don't give a fuck guy. Right? Hey, I'm just saying. I heard Denzel Washington goes to the Golden Globes wearing sweatpants.
Is that right?
That's what I heard. I heard it from one source. I can't confirm it.
Are they tearaways?
No, I don't know.
Because that would be very strong.
I just think he doesn't want to be uncomfortable if he's going to sit there.
If they read your name, you just get up and you just rip them off and you just say, deal with this.
Get your prize.
Yeah.
But what did you, like, I assume after the two movies you made that, you know, this was an opportunity to get more experience. And it seems like you would get a phenomenal amount of hands-on experience doing this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, anytime you're in that chair, you're learning a lot because the job, literally, as you know, you've spent oodles of time on sets. The directors are the people that are kind of the arsonist and the firefighter, you know?
Right.
Most of the time is the firefighting. You're answering questions, you're fixing problems, but your creative plan has a tendency to ignite small little fires all over the place that you have a responsibility to immediately follow with a little can of water and say, no, I understand that the ripple down effect is this, but don't worry, I got that covered with this.
And yeah.
So you just have to have your shit together. I mean, you've got to have a plan, and it is your obligation to communicate that in a succinct way to multiple departments so that all of those efforts funnel into like this same little channel that can shape. The goal is to shape the same experience for a bunch of people that you don't know, that might be in different moods, that are in different houses.
And again, not unlike your family, I imagine you have to, you know, sort of work to have to be grounded in yourself so you don't... I don't know. Like, do you find... Have you ever been a difficult one on the set?
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, you'd have to ask people that I work with. I'm sure there's a couple of people that didn't have a great time. I don't know of any to speak of. But
look, you don't lose your shit.
No, yeah. I'm a big advocate for getting your work done and doing it without screaming, without playing the power dynamic card, which is kind of a lazy kind of rookie thing to do,
right?
Because if you
want to be a worker among workers,
well, there's just a clear fact that anybody who spent time on a set, there's no one there that doesn't need to be there. So the second you start to belittle or dismiss the presence or the contributions of anybody, basically means you don't really understand how the whole magic trick works, because if any one of those people is not doing their job as well as the person next to them, the wheels start to wobble, and you see it on screen. You really do.
Well, that's interesting, because we're talking about this, and now you're in a position where you're running a set, and in that event that happened at that press conference, for Arrested Development, where you sort of had to, I don't know what your impulse was in that moment, but it seemed like you just wanted to make everything okay.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was, and I certainly overshot. Unfortunately, one of the things that was the fallout from that was the opposite of what I just said to you, which was my position about on-set decorum. It sounded like I was okay with and excusing people being disruptive on set or affecting other people's work processes, and that could not be further from the truth. And that's part of me sort of just being thinking that, well, if I just keep talking and people are going to understand what I'm saying and everything's going to be all right, and I just need to shut up and listen a lot more and stop trying to make everything okay. Sometimes maybe that's a control issue, or
sure it
or,
is.
Or, yeah,
well, I mean, I think from our last conversation, I remember there was a sort of a little bit, if not chaos, detachment in the upbringing.
Yeah,
kind of forces you into a self-parenting mode.
Yeah, and it just wasn't my conversation to get into.
What happened after it?
Afterwards, there was hugs and kisses, and we all left that meeting thinking, well, that was a really beautiful thing.
We worked
that
through something.
Well, yeah, because Jessica said, emotionally, I'm going to take this moment to forgive you, Jeffrey, and move forward. And so we all thought that was like an incredibly positive thing, because, we hadn't sat with Jeffrey. We hadn't been with Jeffrey in that setting to hear about everything that
happened on Transparent.
And so it was a really emotional vibe in there. There's a lot of care for him in that room, and for her to be overwhelmed with that and being as generous as she was about putting all that behind her and behind their relationship really felt, I don't know if lovely is the right word, but
cathartic.
It was a really kind and beautiful thing that she did, and so it was obviously surprising to me and to all of us that the backlash that followed. And look, as I said in my apology, I can see from rereading the transcript and hearing an excerpt from it how all of the position that I took could be misconstrued for excusing his behavior, giving him cover, and being insensitive to Jessica. Yeah. And I get that, and I so apologize for that. But she knows that I don't feel that way about her. We've talked since, and all is good. So,
well, good.
I'm glad that it seems to have passed. But I continue to listen and learn a lot, because obviously there was a blind spot there for me that I got a lot to learn about.
Well, I think also, but the blind spot is like, I've been on sets, and the way you're talking about the set that you run, is sort of collaborative and respectful, sometimes jobs are hard, sometimes there are arguments about process, but not abusive. It just happens in the creative process, but you're looking to be in a collaborative creative environment where everyone's doing their job at the best they can
and respecting one another.
That's
and if
right.
somebody has a difficult way in which they go about their work, they have a responsibility to be accountable for that. And
see,
if
and
if it makes somebody else's work process uncomfortable, well, then you either have to change the way you work, or apologize for the way you work, or be accountable, acknowledge the way in which you work. You can't just not say something about it, expect people to adapt, because everybody's process at work and experience at work needs to be a positive one. There's no excuse. There's no reason why it can't be a positive and a pleasurable thing. And if somebody's making that difficult, they need to change, apologize, or adjust.
Yeah. And I think that, like, in the arts, when somebody, you know, over years, and this is like there's obviously an awareness that is elevated now, and rightfully so, and it's right in a paradigm shift around what we tolerate, but not just sexually, but, you know, with just kind of explosive, abusive behavior, because talented people, they used to get this pass.
Yeah.
Right? You
know? It's ridiculous.
But it went on forever. I mean, I've had moments where I've, thrown shit fits, but throwing a shit fit, wandering off and yelling in your trailer at nobody is different than just ruining.
Yeah, there's a way in which to do things, and people, no matter how young they are, I deal with it with my 11-year-old, my 6-year-old. You can see when it is somebody understands the difference between right or wrong.
Uh-huh.
And if they're too young to understand that, well, then there's a different set of judgment. But that passes like at 5.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
My 6-year-old is past the, well, she doesn't know better.
Yeah.
You know, I can sit down and really have a conversation with her.
And,
and that's my job as a parent, to explain to her, I know this feels wrong, and let me tell you why you probably feel wrong about or guilty about what you did,
right,
or how you can make that better. And I'm here to remind you, because you're not going to be perfect, and, you know, every once in a while you're going to miss a little bit, but that's what we're all here to do. And same thing at work. You know, if somebody makes a mistake or steps out of line, well, it's all of our jobs to say, hey, can I talk to you for a second? That made me uncomfortable, and I'd appreciate it if you didn't do that again, and or apologize.
You know, it's interesting, though, is in grownups, it's usually coming from emotionally about the age of your daughter.
It's,
you know, that tantrums and weird emotional reactions and abusive sort of insecurity.
Yeah.
You know, it's all like, you know, the kid stuff.
Yeah. And oftentimes it comes from a place of discomfort and fear.
Yeah.
And I think the one of the most helpful things to avoid that very natural element we all have, that human element, is to create a kind and safe atmosphere.
Sure.
So that people are not fearful and are not insecure at work.
And they feel supported, and that if there's a problem, they have somewhere to go with it.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, good, man. So you directed how many this season?
Just the first two. I didn't get a chance to come home and see my girls and my wife that much last year. And so I just wanted to do the first two, because, you know, we have to shut down if I'm going to direct any episodes that are beyond that, because we're into the season, because you have to prep those.
Right.
So I didn't want to do that, and because then I can't come back during prep, can't come back during directing.
And where are you shooting?
In Atlanta.
And how much do you, because, like, what was great about it, and I don't know how much you had to do with the conception of it or set deck, was that, you know, some of these characters are right at the edge of feeling familiar, you know, Southern weirdos.
Yeah.
But they all have a lot of heart to them, and also the tone of it and where they live seems sort of authentic as opposed to gothic.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I thought was a great testament to the sensitivity of not stereotyping.
Yeah, I mean, listen, 100% of that is the writing, and the other 100% is the performing, and then there's a little bit of the visual, and in our case, the sonic world that you put around that, and the editorial sort of pacing you put around that, because oftentimes you can write a very non-human line for a character by design.
Yeah.
But if you keep the camera there after that person says the line, you can also incorporate the human side of it. In other words, the feeling of guilt or embarrassment for having said that non-human line. So you can create that combination that then lands it for the audience that, oh, there's a lot of heart in that killer.
Yeah, yeah.
Or there's a lot of ignorance in that person that is being intolerant.
You know?
So oftentimes it plays either before or after the line, and that becomes our job in the editing room to make sure that we're not trying to make the show zip along so fast. Like, you've got to let
it breathe
and process.
Yeah, that's where it all happens.
Yeah,
in that editing room.
Yeah.
All right, man. Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to it. I'll see you, at the Emmys if they let me sit in the good seats.
Yeah, we'll be sitting probably right next to each other, sharing snacks.
Good. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Jason Bateman. I like hanging out with him. Season 2 of Ozark premieres on Friday, August 31st on Netflix, as I said earlier. So, Tanya Donnelly and the band Belly, they had a couple of great albums, a couple of nice hits. She also was on the first Breeders record, Pod, which is a great record. And also, we worked at a restaurant together up in Coolidge Corner. Yeah, up there in Brookline. Edibles, the restaurant. I worked with Tanya Donnelly when she was probably still in the Throwing Muses. Oh my God, how am I just spacing that out in this introduction? Throwing Muses. What a great fucking band. Of course I talked to her about that, but I just realized that earlier in my introduction, I did not bring up the Throwing Muses. I just brought up the Breeders and Belly, but Throwing Muses with Kristen Hirsch, that was the fucking band, man. I remember seeing them when we worked at Edibles, in this little place upstairs. I can't remember the name of the place. I'll talk to her about it. But those few Throwing Muses albums are great. But anyways, Tanya, I hadn't seen in a long time. They put out this new Belly record, and it's great. It's a Belly record, and it was great to see her, great to talk to her, great to catch up, great to see that she's never stopped working and does a lot of other, does a lot of stuff, does a lot of recording, just sort of her own songs here and there on different compilations and through a series of records. I was thrilled to see her. So this is me talking to Tanya Donnelly. The new album by Belly called Dove is available wherever you get music. It's the first Belly album in 23 years, folks. Why does it come on? What happens? Well, I'll talk to Tanya Donnelly about it.
So, yeah, you asked me, what have I been doing for the last 30 years?
I have some idea.
Isn't that crazy? And I was there making sandwiches.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And scooping tofutti.
Yeah. That was up front. I never got to the tofutti counter. I was just a sandwich guy. It's so weird because that's like people get frozen in time and you just sort of like, what did they? Because I remember going to see Throwing Muses like somewhere upstairs in a corner. Fuck, it wasn't like T.T. the Bears, but that didn't have much of a stage. Maybe. I mean, it was like, I just remember it was upstairs. There was really no stage.
And it was sort of down, it was downtown.
Yeah, and you're like in a corner.
The T and yes, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's Chet's, yeah.
Yeah, and it was just, there was me and about 12 other people there.
Yeah.
And you guys standing there in
that
the corner.
That sounds about right.
It must have been before the big record, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's where we sort of cut our teeth.
I am sort of fascinated with the whole, like, the new record's great. Sounds like a Belly record.
Good.
It sounds like,
the 20 plus years.
A little older, a little wiser, but it sounds like you guys, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And there was, like, how long between albums? I mean, it seems like...
It was 22 years, something like that.
So just,
years,
it was just took you that long to write those songs? Leonard Cohen?
We were slow moving. Yes, this was our Hallelujah. Like, writhing in pain on the floor. No, it wasn't a hiatus. It was a breakup.
Sure.
And this is,
Right.
This is our 11th hour.
But did you guys remain friends? I mean...
We did. I mean, we're all from Newport, which is a very small place. Our families are close. Our siblings have dated. my family used to spend holidays at the Gorman family, the Greenwood Circle. There's no way to extricate yourself from the island, which is a
Newport, Rhode Island
thing. Yeah.
So, but let's go all the way back then, because, I mean, you were founding member of the Throwing Muses, obviously, and then you were founding member of the Breeders, really, right? First two albums, their first album, then a little something on the second one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Belly happened like during, like simultaneously, right? To the Breeders kind of.
Wait, yeah. I mean, the first, actually the first, the songs on the first Belly album were supposed to be, those were earmarked for Breeders, the second Breeders album, because our, Kim and I had sort of had this plan that she would write the first and I would write the second.
Yeah.
But then the Pixies sort of signed on to this 18-month tour.
Yeah.
And I got antsy, and so.
And what she could never time. She could never get off tour? Is that?
Well, that's basically what it was, and I really wanted to get going because I had just left the Muses. And
I'm just adjusting volume. Hold on.
Yeah, that's fine.
I don't know. You speak lightly, I think.
Yeah, I know.
You do know that?
I do know that. It's been it's been made clear to me.
It's been a problem on radio.
Trait of
like,
mine,
that, like your invisible voice. So, but okay, so. I like the new record, and I had no idea, like, you know, looking around at stuff the, in the last couple of days. I mean, you've been sort of plugging away pretty diligently for the past 2 decades. I mean, those, there's like 4 or 5 of those Swan Song records, and there seems to be like 900 songs throughout the course of those.
And there's a few other solo records as well.
And you do them every few, like, couple of years, right? You just kind of, you know, just kind of record all the songs you're writing?
Yeah, because that, I mean, I never stop writing.
Yeah.
It's a function.
But it's so good that you just kind of, like, there's so many people that we know. Like, I don't know what happened to some of those people.
Yeah.
Do you?
No, but, you know, I have to say that's doing, you know, working in the Boston community and, you know, New England as a whole, it's self-sustaining and it's a very happy, productive life.
Oh, you mean
life,
creatively, you know, just, as a singer and songwriter that there you have a loyal following?
Yeah.
In the area, in the region.
Yes, and you know, I have been to, I have done tours in the interim as well. I did get to a point where, you know, touring from 18 on for so long, I came to a stopping point, what I considered to be a healthy stopping point at the time.
When was that?
That would be probably 2004-ish, something around
so
there.
So let's start out, though, like Newport, Rhode Island, because, like, my idea of Newport, Rhode Island is fancy. I think I was only there once. I was drunk. It wasn't good. It was in a mansion. It was some sort of party. Don't remember why. But it's not fancy.
It's not an uncommon story. Well, if you were in a mansion.
Yeah, but it was like it was a rental. It wasn't
on the right side of the tracks.
Right, but it wasn't like, I wasn't even at the person who owned the house. I think someone rented it for a wedding or something.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
No, it's, I mean, like any place.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly there's a split. I primarily grew up in the Fifth Ward, which is not fancy.
There are wards.
But I love it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how that works.
The Fifth Ward's kind of like the traditionally Irish, you know, Irish, where the Irish landed.
Are you traditionally Irish?
I'm traditionally a lot of things, but yes.
Donnelly.
Primarily. Yeah.
And so, like, but you grew up the whole time there, Newport?
I did, yeah. Yeah. Yep. And we bopped around from apartment to apartment, but that's where I grew up for the most part.
And what's your dad, what was he, like, doing?
He's a plumber.
A plumber in Newport.
He is, and he's also an actor. He does a lot of theater work there. My mom's a legal secretary.
Both plumber.
Retired.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. Like, did he have his own plumbing operation?
He did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And it's extremely helpful.
Oh, hell yeah.
As a homeowner. And,
now?
Yeah. And he used to, you know, he taught us a lot of stuff too. You know, he would come, Kristen and I would actually, and my brother, when we would hear the van pulling up outside the house, we would scatter and hide because it meant if it was during the day, it meant that he had found a pipe he couldn't get his hand into.
Right.
And that's
he
was coming for one of us. No, no.
Oh, he wanted you to come stick your hand in?
Yes. He was coming to pull us into the job.
Oh, you got
to reach into a tight spot.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that only happened a few times, but it was. Rumbling up.
Sure. Who wants to do that as a kid? That doesn't sound like fun.
No.
So wait, Kristen lived with you because you're related?
Step.
How'd that work?
Well, we actually met when we were very young, like 5 or 6, and we became very close.
Yeah.
And then at some point, everyone's parents split up and started marrying each other.
Right.
And that's only a slight exaggeration. And so my dad and her mom hooked up and ultimately got married. So and they're divorced now, but
amicably. And what about like your mom and that crew? Is they friends or how does that all work?
Yeah. It's sort of the same. I'm going to retread what I just said. It's too small for contention. It's too small to...
Maybe for a little while. There must have been a little contention.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's...
Initial?
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. There are words.
Sure.
But, you know, at the end of the day, I really do feel like everyone just has to sort of duke it out and get over it and figure it out because... You're gonna run into somebody.
Sure, and you got kids together, down the street.
Yeah.
So like you know what?
Ugh. Yeah. I mean, it did. There was a sort of like a who's got the kids? Where are the kids? What's you know? There was a little. We didn't have curfews. No one knew where we were.
Right.
And there was a little bit of chaos there, but it was. Loving stewardship.
Oh yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Well, it's like, is it that small a community where like everyone knows the cops?
Right.
So like, how far could you go if you weren't running away?
Yeah.
You'd turn up one way or the other.
Exactly.
Somewhere.
Right. Someone's got their eye on you.
Yeah. So when you guys were kids, and all this was going on, I mean, when did you and Kristen? When do you start playing guitar and doing that stuff?
We started doing that when we were 14. And with the support of both of our dads, like for some reason, she ended up with my dad's guitar and I ended up with her dad's guitar.
Really? You don't know how that happened?
I have no idea.
And you're writing songs or no?
We learned how to play from basically the Beatles songbooks.
Yeah. The big one. And, the one that had Lennon and McCartney on the cover with like the weird binder.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. That
flip binder. Yeah.
Yeah.
But there are those transitions, like the Beatles do these runs, right? Like all these fancy chords.
Yeah.
And that's what kind of laid the wiring, huh?
Right.
Yeah,
absolutely. And Kristen very quickly started to write original pretty much very quickly once we learned how to play.
Yeah.
And I was a little slower coming to that gate, but...
Were you in high school? Were you guys like cool kids?
We were... No.
No.
We were each other's only friend.
Seriously?
Basically.
The weirdos with the guitars?
I'm speaking for myself right now because obviously my perspective.
Are you guys friends still?
Oh, yeah, sure.
You are?
Yeah.
But do you occasionally play together?
We just did, in March, we did three shows in Boston at the City Winery.
The Muses?
Nope, just separate solo acts. And then we did a few songs together at the end.
Was that nice?
It was really nice. Yeah, it was great.
Like, why wouldn't you do that more often?
We talk about it, but it's just, it's our lives, the pace of our lives is very different. She's on nonstop on tour.
Oh really?
So yeah, she's just goes.
Huh. Didn't she have a kid like long before everyone else?
Yes.
Long
before, we were, when we had first moved to Boston when we were like 18 is when she found out she was pregnant.
Right.
Yeah. And then she went back.
Like
Newport.
With a bass player's baby?
No.
Oh.
No.
Okay.
She had three subsequent children with another person, but the first was.
Right. I kind of remember that. Like, I remember that as being like, wow, she's got a kid?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, let's go back, though.
That's how we felt, too. Although it quickly normalized, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
As teenagers touring with a child, it felt, you know, we would say, I shared a room with her, and we would take turns having Dylan and sleep in the bed when he was a baby. And
right.
It just didn't feel after, I don't know, anything normalizes, you know? Anything,
yeah, of course.
You get to a point where.
Sometimes unfortunately.
Yes, sometimes quite unfortunately. yeah.
But so when you're in high school and you're just playing, like, so you start playing in the band before you get out of high school, really?
Yeah.
Really?
We had, so the band, I would say, by the time we were 15.
And who was in the band?
We had our first. Our first round, which was all female at the time.
With who was it?
Elaine Edemides. And Cindy Scanlon was our first bass drummer. And then Becca Blumen. And then we went through, I think, a few before David Narciso joined.
Yeah.
When we were at the end of our junior year, I guess.
In high school.
Yeah.
And you're playing around Newport?
Yep. And then Leslie Langston, who was an older woman at the time, but really now we're the same age. we brought her in as well. She's amazing, amazing bass player.
Are you going to Boston yet?
We're not going to Boston. We played, our first show was at the Newport Art Association.
All originals?
All originals, yeah.
Yeah?
And a Yoko Ono song.
Oh, really? Which one?
Never Say Goodbye.
And Kristen sang that?
We took turns.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I don't know the song, but I imagine it's got to get pretty high up there.
It's beautiful.
It does.
That one doesn't have any of the acrobatics. It's just kind of a straightforward
song. Straight up song?
Yeah.
So you
really great song. Beautiful song.
So what year are we talking here?
So that would be 1981.
So this is like pretty you wanted to have a girl group full of strong lady voices.
Sort of at the time. At the time, that was kind of, we sort of try to go back and dig that, tease this apart. And was that intentional? Did we have or was it just the people we knew?
Right. What'd you come up
with? So I think it might have just been the people we knew, because when Dave joined, that was seamless. It wasn't
right. You're the guy.
Now there's a boy.
Right.
There was no transition period.
Well, I just think that choosing of a Yoko Ono song out of all songs to cover in the world seems like, you had a mission in some way.
Yeah. Well, we were big. We sort of, I think also we were just huge fans of hers in general. I continue to be.
My girlfriend's a huge fan. I don't know a lot of her stuff, and I guess I know she's a very prolific artist in a lot of different ways, but I don't know.
It's not for everyone.
Well, it's not even that. I don't even know if I've really judged her properly. I've seen some of her art, and I think it's okay. But there is a big bunch of art there that I haven't experienced. But I'm told that
experience is the word. Yeah, I carried grapefruit around when I was a teenager in my
for what
everywhere. Just to as reference, I don't know. I just wanted
what's
it just
grapefruit?
Was like a grapefruit what? Is a Yoko Ono.
Oh, it is.
Yeah,
it's a book.
It's a book of her.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, you carried the book around.
I did. I loved it.
What was it
like a little sort of 5x5 pocket?
What was it that resonated version? So much?
The positivity of it.
Yeah.
And just sort of the just how streamlined and simple it was, but just still powerful to me.
Yeah.
You know, I just felt like it really did resonate with me. It really.
Now I got to get it. I bet you my girlfriend has it. See what's going to happen now after I talk to you. I'm going to be like, do you have any of that Yoko Ono stuff? She's going to be like, I've been telling you for 3 years. You know, I'm like, well, I just talked to Tanya. Like, why don't you listen to me? That's what's going to happen.
I mean, full disclosure, I haven't revisited her work as in decades, but it was big
influence
for me.
Did you all finish high school?
We did.
And you stayed in Newport, and and how many songs did you end up sort of like amassing or writing before, by the end of high school? Did you have a pretty good set?
Yeah, we did. But, yeah. I mean, dozens, I would say. Not all of them made the cut.
Yeah.
But a lot of it was sort of this, let's try this, let's try this, let's try this. And the things that were sort of very more stylized fell by the wayside as soon as we found our own voice and, our own pace. And so a lot of those sort of training wheel songs were left behind for the most part.
And so you're in a band. It's you. And by the time you graduate high school, David's in the band.
Yeah.
And Scanlon is out?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I like the Irish
Ann
names.
Ann Blumen. Yeah.
Ann Blumen's out.
Yeah.
But did you grow up crazy Catholic or?
No. My parents were pretty much atheists for the most part.
Oh, yeah?
And, yeah. So.
He was a groovy plumber.
Came from nowhere. There's a lot of Catholic DNA.
Sure.
Rosary in my double helix.
Yeah.
But it's...
Is that a lyric?
It's on mute. it's dormant at the moment. And then Ashkenazi on my mom's side, but again, same...
You came have a Jewish mom?
Came through... Well, great-grandmother who came and grandfather came.
Yeah.
But their families came... Not practicing, though. No observance.
Sure,
so
sure.
I don't claim anything.
Right.
I'm really careful on both sides with
to not claim
any religious affiliation because I don't have any experience with any of it. But from that side, they came through Greenwich Village beatniks that basically rejected everything.
And really?
And my mom's parents.
Were beatniks?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Basically.
So you have sort of like a nice hippie pedigree there.
Yes.
And your dad's parents, where were they? Were they in Newport?
Naval commander.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Full on.
But very, honestly, as liberal as you can be within that, you know. Structure.
And you knew them, so they were around when you were growing up.
Yes, both of my grandparents. My parents had me very young. I was a teen result as well.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. So I knew my grandmother's still alive.
Really?
My paternal grandmother. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
New England people are very unique.
Hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like they're it's for good and bad, but like when I go back there, I don't do much.
Mm-hmm.
There's something so distinctive about like certain areas, like New England, Philly. There's like a kind of rough, kind of but compassionate bunch.
Pragmatism.
Yeah. But yeah. With an edge to it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yep. It's true.
So all right. So wait. So now Kristen gets pregnant in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. So then, okay, so now she's got a kid by what, senior year?
She's got a kid by end of senior, no, so it was the summer after.
Wow.
Is that right? Wait, let me do this math. Winter after, I guess, yeah.
What year did you graduate?
So, 84. And he was born in 86, he was actually born in 86. So
huh.
There was a little gap.
And so everyone was like, what? What's happening?
Yeah.
You're going to, okay.
Right.
I guess.
Yeah. But there wasn't a moment, I have to say, there was once, as soon as she decided to have him, we were fully on board. There was no talk for a second of maybe the band won't happen.
You're still full steam ahead.
Absolutely.
She had the baby. She figured
out. Full steam ahead. We signed to 4AD during that period.
It's a British label?
Yeah.
How did that signing happen?
We sent the tape. We were Cocteau Twins fans and sent the tape to him because that's how we had heard it at 4AD, to Ivo Watts-Russell. And he had this policy of not signing any American bands at the time, but he wanted to mentor us and sort of get us. He basically sort of unofficially managed us for that demo.
The guy from the Cocteau Twins?
The label owner of 4AD, the guy that started 4AD.
Okay.
And then he got to the point where he felt like he was starting to get too attached, and so he signed us.
Were you the first American band?
We were the first American band.
Yeah, okay.
And then
Throwing Muses, first American band.
And then we brought the Pixies with us, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So now, like, in order to be, like, hanging out as teenagers still and, you know, signing record contracts and touring, I'd imagine, mm-hmm. with a baby, I'm assuming that you guys weren't out of control in any way.
Like, no, not at all.
You didn't
live the rock
and roll lifestyle.
Right. And we had some people who immediately, and Salem 66, those, you know, among them, just sort of, and the Mission of Burma guys, the Birdsongs people, like, there were just this kind of group of people that
good folks
helped.
Yeah.
You know, like, really pulled us up and supported and gave us sort of a template in a way. And introduced us to the community. And you know, so we had a lot of, and Gary Smith, 100, very, very important to us.
Who's that guy?
Gary owned, was the owner of Fort Apache.
Fort Apache, right. I think I talked to maybe Janowitz about that.
Yeah. And he managed me, he managed Juliana Hatfield, he managed Natalie Merchant, and he produced Muses records, Pixies records, The Chills. He's a renaissance.
Juliana Hatfield.
Yeah.
I remember her. I think she sent me a bunch of records. I got to get up to speed on her. Like, I end up doing a lot of catch up.
She's fantastic.
Yeah, no, I'll get into it. Where does she live?
She's in Boston, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I remember hearing her name.
I'm married to her bass player, to her. That's how I met my husband, was on tour with her.
You had one husband?
Actually, I have one 25 years old.
25 years?
We've been together,
husband.
Yeah.
And babies?
Two, 19 and 12 girls.
Older?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know why my brain keeps wanting to put us back in Boston. Like, it was just, it's so weird when you miss a chunk. Remember Fat Mike, the manager? Big Fat Mike with the beard? Yeah. We used to do coke with Mike. I wonder if he's still around.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That was.
Yeah. Yeah. And Ira and Bunny.
Yeah.
Ira and Bunny were the owners.
Oh, my God. Yes.
Big Ira, doofy Ira, and little sort of round bunny.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's all there, like, flashing before my eyes.
Right. I always had a problem because they had these sandwich steamers that I just never understood in retrospect. Like, these steam tables where you do, like, if someone ordered it, you take a whole pita, lay it flat.
Oh, yeah.
Put the tuna on it, and then like sprouts and tomatoes and cheese on top.
Yes.
And put it in the steamer.
It
and
was
go,
such a weird. I feel like everything there was just
wet.
Was kind of just slightly off grid in terms of how everything functioned. Like, and it had
was
like sort
soggy.
Of one of those faux health food deli.
Do you remember
vibes, where it was?
Yeah.
Like
right.
this is healthy.
Yeah, it was hippie. It wasn't really, healthy.
Yeah, right.
It was like hippie.
Yeah.
You remember the Caribbean singer Keith?
Oh, that yeah, guy. Yeah, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. You have an amazing memory.
And George, the other Caribbean guy, the cricket player.
I have to admit that I actually went on my own, like, wiki page last night to bone up on my own chronology because I know that your memory is...
It's not good. I was there today. I'm not that great.
Okay.
My memory's not that great.
It's like, I have to remember my own life if I'm going to be revisiting it.
Well, I mean, I just like, there's something about like that, you know, what you came into and even like somewhat before us as well there, because I'm a little older than you, not much. I graduated high school in 81.
Right.
Right. So, like, yeah. But there was a generation of Boston music that happened before us.
Yeah.
Like with the Cars, Modern Lovers, and like that crew.
Amazing,
but,
yeah,
but they laid this out. And like in your generation, I think was... That was like, it seems like maybe not the end of it, but there was before they plowed under, you know, Kenmore Square.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was really this vital place. I've had Amy Mann on a few times, and she was a little older than us when she was doing that Till Tuesday thing.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
But now she's like, I think as a solo artist, probably generationally alongside of you guys.
Yeah, I think so. A little bit, maybe. But she was more of a paver. She was a few years ahead. And,
yeah. Who do you see the other pavers as? Mission to Burma, weren't they?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
So was your class like the Dogmatics? Scruffy?
We were, definitely peers.
Yeah.
It's funny because like Boston, I think looking back through the lens, everything seems to combine and conflate into this.
Yeah.
They all hung out together and everyone, there was this, you know, cohesive scene. And to an extent that is true. But there were pockets of friend groups among, you know, people who played with each other more often than, like, it was like the Neats, the Flies, the Dogmatics, that, you know.
The Neighborhoods?
The Hoods, yeah.
The Hoods, that was and Judy's boyfriend was in the
David,
Hoods.
David, yeah, and they're actually current friends of mine now because their kids went to school together.
So what do they do now?
He owns a studio in, out there, and she sort of supports that, and we kids, both of us.
And so. And everyone's good?
He owns a studio in
Recording
Arlington.
Studio?
Yeah, really great.
In Arlington?
In Arlington, Woolly Mammoth, it's great.
Good. Wow, so they stayed in the game and made, because because I talked to, when I talked to Janowitz, he's a real estate agent. He's fine with it.
Yeah.
You
know what? I was listening to that interview and I need to be his PR person right now because he actually runs a niche.
A real estate niche?
Yes, like absolutely. It's his. It's this, you know, sort of mid-century modern and he does quite well and he's extremely educated in his, and he loves that architecture as a fan of it. You know, he doesn't half-ass anything. That guy. Yeah. So, I mean, I was listening to it and I was like...
Yeah, get proud of it?
Yeah, a little more braggadocio.
I think that one of the reasons he might not have is because, that's one of the... Like, I didn't know that stuff about him, you know? Like, I don't know how people function. In my game, like comedy, or in your game, like when shit goes, not even south, but when you just sort of like, you know, you've had your shots and it just levels off. So how do you survive?
Right.
So I feel like he was probably speaking from not shame per se, but, you know, he was talking about a new Buffalo Tom album.
Yeah.
He didn't seem not proud of it, but I don't think he was there to plug his real estate
business.
To plug
that, right. Exactly. And I'm not here to plug my doula business either.
But that's sort of kind of fascinating. No, I think it's important, actually, for people to hear that stuff.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like so many, because you're still doing what you love doing and you may have this other thing that you also are engaged with but can generate some a living out of a bit. But there's no shame in that. And I think that people put all their eggs in one basket and they don't really hear the other stories. Mm-hmm. Like they just assume that it's a tragedy. Like, you know, what happened to that person? Can't be good.
And that is like, it's funny, like coming back to the belly thing, which is by far the most high profile thing that I've been involved in, that is the that's a running question is, what have you been doing? You know, it's like, well, it's been 2 decades. That's a very difficult question.
Right, to sum it up.
I feel like Bill and I both also are in a similar place where we're quite happy with the way things have panned out for
right.
us. And as is everybody in Belly, you know, everyone's been busy. Everyone has businesses. Collectively, we run our own businesses. We have families. We have, you know, it's a lot, but it is, you know, I understand why, you know, I about other artists will be like, well, they really fell off the radar.
Right.
So I understand, you know, clearly. When someone goes away,
but what is that? But what the fuck is that radar? When you really think about it, I mean, we're in our 50s now, right?
Yeah.
So you know, it's like who determines that radar?
Right.
Like, see, obviously, you know, you developed enough of a following to where you can go play gigs with mm-hmm. supportive fans, probably of all ages, with kids. I'd imagine at this
yes.
point in time,
which and, is bizarre, but well, yeah, but adult children,
sure.
At all. But really? Yeah.
It's bizarre, but it's sort of lovely that, you know, mm-hmm. you can do that when you want to do that. And how is that not, you know, mm-hmm. the exact trajectory? I mean, like, even the biggest bands in the world get sad after the 5th or 6th album.
You know,
you know what I mean? It's like, what is this radar people are talking about?
Right.
You know, when people start repeating themselves, you're like, no, this is not going. This is it, I guess, for the rest of it. This is they're going to play the hits and look like that now as they get
yeah,
older.
Right. And that's a whole other.
Well, yeah, and then they're sustaining this machine. But I do want.
I feel like the bandwidth has changed around that though, because everything is so much more porous informationally. Like, there's so much. There's so many streams of communication and information that the radar has changed.
There's no,
so it's actually much more inclusive.
Yeah, and there's
those
no more
of us who have made different choices.
Right, and there's also no more late to the party. Is that if somebody, let's say, you know, someone who's a fan of yours from when you were younger is a mom now, and he turns her kid on to you, mm-hmm. that kid can go online and go all the way back to, you know, Throwing Muses, and then have this whole world open up to them because the technology allows people to do that.
Yes, and that's a recurring story. Is I found you through the Pixies, or I found, you know, Throwing Muses through Bella, or, you know, they just that family of bands does have much more of a melting pot following now than which is nice.
Yeah, anybody, like even like me, who you think you've been around and somewhat public forever, and then people are like, I didn't know you were a comic. I'm like, what the fuck? You know, like, how is that possible?
No.
You know, sure.
Really?
Of course.
Okay, that's
like, yeah, because
weird.
Now I'm on the Netflix show on Glow.
Yeah.
Like, so people are like, who's mm-hmm. that guy? And they're like, oh, he's got a podcast. So like, what am I? I'm not, you know, I'm not Kanye. Of course there's, most people don't know who we are. So mm-hmm. like, they can all just, you know, all it takes is one search and they're going to like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
There's all these records.
Right.
It's kind of
which is great.
It's great.
Really nice because I don't have to walk into any situation with my resume. Do you know? You know what I mean? Which is so nice because it's all been done for me with a click of.
Yeah,
you know,
you built
the upside of it. Yeah.
So when you guys let's go back though. So you sign with 4AD,
mm-hmm.
and then you brought the Pixies in. How close were you with those guys?
Very close. That they
still.
Yep. I mean, not so much. It's Kim and I are still friends.
Yeah.
And Kelly and the whole, all of
the deal people.
Yeah. And
but not
and Josephine and the whole Jim, all of them.
But not Francis.
No, I kind of fell out of touch with him. Yeah.
What's his real name?
Charles.
Charles. Yeah.
Yeah.
So okay, but he's up in like what, the Pacific Northwest somewhere.
I don't know where I don't even know where he
But back in the day, you guys were tight.
Yeah.
Do you remember
that? Yep, and he actually, my boyfriend Reed at the time, back then, Charles and Reed became very close, and Reed still opens for them quite often.
Uh-huh.
So he's kind of...
In what band?
Hold on to that.
Solo?
By himself, really, yeah.
So now this is your first, so when do you move to Boston? After you get the record deal?
No, we moved to... Yes, yeah, actually, yes. I think that was sort of... That might have been simultaneous. Because it was the year, I want to say it was the summer after high school that we started communicating with Ivo and he became interested. So yeah, that would have been.
Yeah. And then you made the first record.
And then we made the first record. We demoed
Throwing Muses record.
Demoed with Gary Smith.
Yeah.
We sent it and then we recorded with Gil Norton.
And now you're in Boston, living where? Mm-hmm. Somerville or somewhere?
Arlington.
All the way out there, yeah. Arlington.
All the way out. I know, that's how we felt when we moved there. We were just, are we going to make this massive 5 mile leap into a new area code? God forbid.
So you're like through the late 80s, you're cranking out the records, and then Hunky Papa's got like a little hit on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're like, you kind of blow up a bit.
Yep.
Headlining. Yeah. No more opening for the Pixies.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And you know, at that point, there was not, you know, I just was just starting to write more, and that's why I left. It wasn't like a contentious. It was just very logistically, you know, just this is...
Why you left the Muses?
Yeah. Kristen gets this many songs, and when my piece started picking up, and I started writing more, and...
You're like, I need
space.
Yeah, get these songs out.
And it was going to be a side project. It was going to be their second Breeders record initially. That was going to be sort of a side project.
Well, how'd you get involved with the Breeders on the first one? Because I love that first record.
Kim and I just really, on the very first Pixies Muses tour, we just really bonded and became very, very close. And at the end of the tour, we just decided... in some ways it was just an excuse to sort of hang out.
Right.
But also she was feeling sort of the same thing I was, which is I'm writing too, a lot too. And so we started to just kind of meet up at her house or mine and writing and playing.
Was she out of control yet?
No.
Yeah.
No, not at that point.
So...
I think we started, we kind of entered our tricky stages simultaneously, but... Uh-huh. I bailed sooner.
Yeah. Yeah. That first Breeders record, that's the one with the Happiness is a Warm Gun cover.
Yeah.
That's such a good record.
Yeah.
It's so different. It stands alone. Because like by the time Last Splash is like that, the musical sort of sonic texture of that record is like a complete kind of mind fuck. But like that first one is very clean, really.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah. That's very Albini. He did a lot of editing.
Pod?
Yeah, just sort of stripping off harmonies where they didn't need to be and paring things down. And he doesn't like to take credit for anything he does, but watching him at work was pretty inspiring.
He loves
inspiring.
Her. I mean, he loves her like beyond like...
Yeah.
I talked to him and like, you know, the way he talks about her after all the artists he's ever produced.
Yeah.
It's like he's just loves her.
Yeah. She's really, I have to say in terms of inspiration, watching somebody's process, she's one of my, she blows my mind.
What about it?
Just the way she approaches songwriting and the way she approaches production. And she's so, you know, even when things were messy with us,
between you or just when
no,
you
no,
were
no.
fucked up?
As the, when the two of us were, we're spiraling. She, just the clarity, her clarity, her focus was still always present. It was, you know, she's just very, she knows what she wants. She works until she gets it. She has real vision.
Yeah.
And, you know, for someone, I have a more of like a, where's the song going to take me? Kind of. Where's this going to go? And she's so in charge.
She knows beginning, middle, and end what she wants.
And that's something that rubbed off on me a bit in a very good, you know, in a very positive way for me.
Like it's a work ethic thing.
Yeah, yes, yes. And I've always had a strong work ethic, but hers is, you know, I mean, all-nighters.
But did you find
like until it's done kind of work ethic?
Do you feel like some of your kind of like, let's see where it takes me was, fueled by some sort of insecurity?
Yes.
Right. So because like people who are decisive, I have a fear of finishing.
Yeah. Well, because I feel like some of my fear of finishing is because I feel like that is something that you have to decide because music is kinetic and there's never it's not fixed.
Yeah.
And so there's never going to be a point where you're sitting with your song and say, there, it's done. And back to Hallelujah. Like no, you have to at some point you have to pull the trigger.
And put it, lay it down.
And just
freaking
record it.
Right.
And then, and maybe later live you can you know, you can keep evolving and moving with it.
So in your mind, all the songs are still active.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
Every night.
I think that's just another way of looking at it.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, maybe some people who are more tight and like sort of like know, like, you know, I talked to Paul McCartney. I don't think he thinks that way. Like, you know, where are we going to go with Hey Jude tonight?
Right, right, right. Yeah. Yeah. No, and we're not, believe me, we're not a jam band. There's not that much improvising going on.
No, I know.
It's more just sort of, you know, I just figured out what I want to do with this vocal, or I'm going to change this word because it bugs me.
Yeah, and do it live, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I get it. But I mean, some guys, you know, sometimes they make, I go either way with that, with like old songs when the old bands try to make them fresh. I'm like, really? You're going to speed it up that much?
If it goes too far.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking yesterday to Sky Daniels about this and KCSN and just, how Dylan, you know, he's like, Dylan will be halfway through a song, and you're like, is this like Rolling Stone?
Yeah.
I understand that.
I think
need to sort of entertain yourself and keep yourself invested.
Right, yeah.
But there's also, it can go to a point.
I think that a lot of Dylan is there. There's a lot of fuck you in Dylan.
Like, yes, which I enjoy.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Where, you know, like he garbles fucking songs for a decade and then he puts out a crooner record.
Right.
It's almost sort of like, nah, joke's on you, idiots.
Yeah. I mean, I feel that like that Victoria's Secret ad was the biggest middle finger too. Like things like that where he's just like,
what does he care?
You don't know what I'm going to. Yeah. Yeah.
It's just so funny. The guy's just like, you know, he's this human museum out there.
Right.
You know, moving through time still. He seems to just want to, you know, die in a hotel room somewhere in a strange suit. That's like his end game. It's like after playing a state fair somewhere. But it's true.
Yeah.
But like, I'm right. Like, of
with
course.
A klezmer band.
Yeah. Why wouldn't he go out like that?
Yeah, right. No, I mean, that sounds, it's fun to observe. And I have to say, like, I get it.
I love him.
I love him too. I love that.
I love
that energy.
I can't, like, I haven't kept up with him lately.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, okay. So then, so you and Kim do that
mm-hmm.
pod record, which is a great record. And then you get all fucked up on drugs in London.
Yeah, not the same. We weren't, not the same drugs.
Right. What was your drug?
This was a relatively brief time, but it felt like forever. Ecstasy.
Oh, yeah?
And coke.
Oh, yeah. So a little up, a little down.
Yeah, and I'm so, you know, I feel, this is like, it's hard for, you know, I this isn't something that a lot of people know about me. My friends do, and I have talked about it before, but it's, you know, I'm cagey about getting into it too much because I did sort of walk away from that and left it completely behind, thinking I can just make this go away.
Uh-huh.
I can just erase this.
Yeah.
I can, you know, excise this part of my life. No, you can't do that.
There's no loose ends. It was just a period.
There are no loose ends. There are people that I would like to have some sort of closing argument / hug.
you can do that.
I don't know. It's funny because like this Belly reunion, the model has been when we first. We're having an email conversation about, are we going to get back together? What do you want to do?
Yeah.
Should we get a mediator? Do we need to revisit things?
Oh, so it was people in the band.
No. This is a
separate thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like, we sort of decided that we're going to draw a line in the sand.
Yeah.
We're going to redline the whole thing.
Yeah.
We're going to move forward.
Right.
And we're not going to revisit.
Yeah.
And it's been very successful, and I actually feel like I want to apply that to other relationships in my life from this point. Just sort of, you know, face forward, move forward,
but discuss it.
Discuss,
but not drag out.
Yeah,
right,
and not do any like real scatological work.
Yeah, right.
Do you know which is what it feels like after a while? Is just like, why are we digging into this?
But there is a way, like, you know, like in the program of recovery,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, you were lucky that you didn't get, you know, that wasn't your life. But there is the amends process, which, you know, creates a context for that. Like for individuals to take responsibility for their side of something and own it to the other person. And then whatever goes on, goes on. But at least you've unburdened yourself to a degree.
Yes.
Right?
And that we have done.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That's the best you can do.
Yeah. Right. And that is something that I feel like. And, you know, I think I would have done that had we not gotten back together, because this would have been, at the end of my life, my one big regret if we hadn't had this moment.
You and Belly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have other regrets, but this would have been the one that would have haunted me.
Breaking up the band without closure?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And just sort of my bad behavior, everyone's, you know, just sort of in general, just how we...
Well, how did it end?
It just... It was.
You don't want to drag it up with me. We don't want to go into the.
Yeah.
You don't want to be that. You don't want to put your hand in the pipe.
Right. Yes, I can. I can tell you the. I can give you the soil.
Yeah.
But I can't tell you what grew there. Okay. So it was basically like just 18 months of. This is so whiny, but we were on this real nonstop road, and it felt like we couldn't even sit down, or it would all.
Oh, with the touring.
And, yeah.
After the two records, after King. Or
Yeah. And just sort of, you know, you have people, we each had, different voices in our ears with different expectations. Uh-huh. Our expectations changed. You know, just very, it's not a very interesting story.
Right.
It's just sort of.
A lot of people pulling at you and you were exhausted.
Yes.
Right.
Yep.
And things, and you sort of hit a plateau. You plateaued.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't an explosion. It was a crumble.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah. But there was still some bad blood or a little resentment.
Yeah, in the beginning, mm-hmm. and then which at this point we're sort of like,
what was that about?
Yes, it's nice to have like such a terrible memory too, which is helpful.
it's
hard to maintain animosity when you can't remember what.
That's age, though. You know.
Yeah,
that's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So when did you like? Because you know the Belly records were great, and obviously the I like that Breeders record,
mm-hmm.
but now I look and you've done a lot of solo records and you're constantly writing songs and playing and you know but when did you, was there a crisis of like, you know, what am I going to do now? When did you become a doula? When did that, like, what was the need to do that?
That was driven from experiences of my own with my kids where I could have used some postpartum support.
So you're
I mean, I had a lot. My dean is
your
100% with me on everything. But in terms of just a little more experiential knowledge from someone who had who had been in this emotional place. And, you know, I felt like I was the classic sort of panicking every second, but not accepting any help, you know.
About being
just
a new mother?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Just feeling sort of at sea and scrambling. And for, you know, I've just for my usual level of my high functioning level, just to have that be out of my grasp in this new, this extremely important new situation.
Of having a baby?
Yeah. I think having someone to just say, this is normal. That's fine.
Yeah.
Let that go. This is, you know, just, you know,
a little
clarity.
Right.
And
sometimes if it's a significant other who's there with you all the time, you're going to take out whatever anger or frustration you're having. Like, what do you know? And like, know it. Right.
Unfortunately.
So when did you have that first kid? What point in the career was it?
That was in 99. It was after my first solo.
So you're out of Belly already.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So there's a whole new life now.
Whole new life.
Solo.
Whole new life, yeah.
Solo Tanya.
Yeah.
Family.
Yeah.
And so the first kid was rough. It was rough.
It was just more, the learning curve for me was steep and long.
Now,
but not rough. I mean, I wouldn't say rough because that was, you know, just that experience.
Now, was Kristen there to help you out?
Yeah, she gave me some tips, but she was, you know, touring.
Always out there, huh?
What
kind of room is she playing?
I'm not really, you know, it changes sometimes. Uh-huh. It depends on what her incarnation is, because she still does music. She does 50 Foot Wave. She's solo. So she has a it depends on who she's with.
Right.
The size of them. It's, you know, clubs to theaters to coffee, you know, coffee has, it's depending on what she's.
Wow. She just doing. Loves it. She's just moving all the time. So do you help people give birth?
No, I was trained initially for birth work, but then I couldn't really weave that into my life very easily. So I,
because you never know what's gonna. We
yeah,
need you
and
now.
I can't pause, like I can't put my own kids on pause for 3 days
right.
and disappear.
Yeah.
So I moved to postpartum, which is more easily schedulable and sort of more my.
Uh huh.
Not my area of interest, but I'm better at it.
Right.
Well, for whatever reason.
But that's still considered a doula. That's a postpartum doula.
Yeah.
Now,
and that business is on hold. I should be clear that I put that.
No,
on
you're not
hold
taking
to
calls.
Do. I'm not taking calls.
Okay.
No, I've had that since the you know, just like
the belly
kind of
tour.
Focusing.
Sure.
I'm
right curious
now.
About it. So, but when you did it, you it was not a decision to stop doing music. It was a decision to help have another stream of income.
Yeah. And to have some other area. To be honest. Something where I was being helpful to someone
right.
else.
Yeah, that's a good part of the life.
Yeah, well, the focus was not
service
on me.
Right.
And service.
Yeah.
That's what, you know, and I felt called to do it, dramatic as that sounds, you know, that just this is a way that I can really dig in and be useful.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And how does one train to do that? What is
there are several organizations that you can train through.
And what is it?
And it depends, you can kind of tailor your own level of training too.
But where does the doula word come from? Where does that tradition
it's a Greek
come
word.
From? Oh, okay.
And it actually means the word doula actually originally meant female servant.
Uh-huh.
But now it's
like sort of a it feels like a new thing, the field. Feels new to me. Is it not?
It's not. And I mean, it's sort of...
I guess there was a midwife back in the day?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And that actually is where, back in the 60s, it kind of came from that movement, the midwifery movement. But.
And so what you basically do is you go talk to panicky new mothers? Am I holding it right?
Yeah. Well, it's amazing how, you know, I think every, you know, you just sort of, however you can say to yourself, it's okay if this isn't intuitive, but that's not how it feels. It feels frightening if it's not intuitive, viscerally coming up with.
So it's frightening, and also you're like, why am I not? I should be able to just, that kind of thing.
Yep. Huh. And lactation's a big piece of it, but there's also just, you know, sleep help and swaddling and just, holding the baby while someone takes a shower.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it can be that simple, you know.
Yeah,
but it's it's a funny culture, though. In it's interesting because I feel like it does. You know, there are times when I want to say, your sister just called and said she'd bring food, and you said you've got this.
Yeah,
you know, and just say yes. Teaching people to say yes.
Uh-huh.
Teaching women to accept help and understand that doesn't mean they're not succeeding in parenting.
That they're not failing in that, that your sister's not better than you.
A lot of issues.
Yep, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it brings up.
Oh, I can't imagine.
Everything.
Sure.
Yeah.
Like life isn't competitive enough. Now you got to now you got to compete about whose kids got what and whether you're doing it
and
right.
And if
or
you're
not.
Doing this right and
how
your choices weigh against other people's choices.
You need a lifetime doula.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's actually that's what my husband is always like. You should be a band doula. Bands need doulas.
That might be right. That might be right. So now tell me about the audiences. I mean, are these people our age who are like, I remember you, like 50-year-old women with dyed hair still?
Absolutely.
And,
but then also, you know, Billy had sort of a big gap between our initial audience, the sort of Feed the Tree.
Yeah. That was the big hit for you guys, right?
Yeah. They were a solid decade younger than we are.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because by the time... We were already in our...
That was the first record,
in our mid-20s.
Was that the first record?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were in our mid-20s, and the bulk of our audience was teens early 20s,
right.
You know.
Uh-huh.
So it's still... It really runs. And yeah. like I said, you know, people bring their adult kids and yeah. their kid kids. And and I think that also, you know, my 19-year-old is her experience of music is so different than mine. It's not necessarily generational. Uh-huh. She sort of has a wide scope of stuff that she listens to. Right. So we have that sort of new crowd uh-huh. also.
Right.
The people that
yes,
discovered you.
For the most part, it is us.
Uh-huh. It is us.
Yeah.
And they're happy, right? They're happy to see you.
They're totally happy. And we're happy to see them. It's really very... It's oddly conversational.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
a lot of talking uh-huh. that goes on. And I don't know. We just sort of... I like them so much.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very... Very, very positive in that room, always.
Yeah, and it's a community in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, these are your people. Like
right.
it's sort of weird.
Yeah, the hardcore. They're the hardcore yeah. last standers. It's
sure.
really nice.
But you know,
yeah.
it also enables you to sort of like be comfortable with your authentic self.
Yes.
Right.
Absolutely. Yes.
You don't have to play games anymore.
No. Nope.
Yeah. This. Yeah.
It's so different.
Yeah.
It feels really good. And you know, I feel like. The fact that people genuinely like the new album
yeah.
too adds validity. It's not so much a vanity project
right,
anymore,
right.
or some nostalgia
right,
trip. It,
right.
it really, for us, it gives some credence to what we're doing. It makes us feel, you know, relevant.
Right.
And,
yeah,
and
absolutely.
That, you know,
and also, what's,
not that there's anything wrong with a reunion tour on its own.
Yeah,
you know, I'm fine. That would have been fine too if that's all we did.
But it's sort of weird because, like, in you know, obviously you're playing stuff from the first two records, but
yeah.
But the thing is like it's not really a reunion tour because you released a record and it's a belly record and oddly as you know it's informed by everyone's age and wisdom,
mm-hmm.
but you guys have a sound.
Still same four people.
Think about how many people don't have a fucking sound. Like you mm-hmm. know like. There are bands out there just plugging away, and they just they listen to their heroes too much, and you can hear other people in them, you know.
Yeah.
And it's not that they're bad musicians, but they haven't like landed on that thing that defines them. And you guys have that. And
oh,
that's
thank
a,
you. That's nice.
Amazing thing,
that's
really.
Very kind.
No, it's
yeah.
true. And and aside from that, it was great seeing you.
It was great seeing you too. Happy to see you, Dad.
And, yeah,
you
too.
And congratulations on everything that
you. Well, thank
we were
you.
On the, we were in the car on yeah. the way here, and Jess said to my friends with me, "Was like, I think Paul McCartney was there yesterday." I said, I was quiet for a second. I said, "Am I the least auspicious person he's ever talked to?"
No. I don't even know what auspicious means,
that.
I don't think.
I want that.
What
though.
Is auspicious?
That's the title that
what
like,
is it?
Like, you know, celebrated.
No. Yeah. I've had, you're definitely not the least auspicious.
Right. I want a carved, I want that to be.
The my, least, you want to be the
I
least
I want
auspicious?
That to be my, yes.
Well, to set the record straight, he didn't come here. I had to sort of like, I got included in a Capitol Records event
mm-hmm.
where he was a special surprise guest at this yearly thing they do, this confab.
Oh,
so it was sort of an in-house thing where, you know, I agreed to do it if I could
right.
use the podcast. So I talked to him in front of 800 people. It was it was not like this candid.
That's great.
It is, but I wonder what it would have been like
if it was like this.
Like
yeah.
right here.
Right,
it's a very
right.
different thing doing a live thing, especially with an entertainer like him who's got this, you know, when you're.
He's got his thing down.
Sure. When you live in front of an audience, you know, you naturally are going to,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's a different thing, but it was still pretty good. It was pretty good.
Right.
But this was nice for me because I'm not. You know, reminiscing about a Beatles history. You know,
right.
We have a lot of shared history. And it was nice seeing you.
It was really nice to see you, too.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
Tanya Donnelly, what a nice catch-up. Not catch-up. What a nice catch-up session we had. Belly's new album, Dove, is available wherever you get music. And it's exciting. I mean, it sounds like a Belly record, and they haven't done a Belly record in 23 years. It's nice. I'm on the road, no guitar. Just one jazz phrase from my mouth trumpet. Boomer lives! That was real phlegm.